Welcome, everybody, to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle.
Welcome. Bienvenue.
It's a podcast about movies and wine. And for those of you out there who don't know shit about one or the other topic, my name is Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
He's Jamie. I'm Scott. I'm your movie guy. And we are here to help you, dear listener. Each episode, we pair a movie that I love with a wine that he loves.
We tell you why we like them, how they're made, and why they work. Hopefully, we find a pairing that works. Usually, we do not.
We
don't even try.
Like today. Today, we're on part two of Jamie's unimaginatively named Court of Master Sommelier's Tasting Flight. Jamie, what are we drinking this time?
So today, my dear friend, we are on the second wine of our flight. Typically, you start with three whites, move on to three reds. Wow. Doing a bad job with my R's and W's.
Yeah, you are.
Haven't even started drinking yet. Anyway, we are on the second white of the day. This is Domaine Huet's Le Mont Demi-Sec 2017, which is available for your drinking pleasure at Crush Wine Company. That's crushwineco.com for $39.95. This, Scotty Too Hottie, is the most expensive of the wines in our CMS tasting flight. When I put this flight together, I told you this wine was textured, focused, and young, and not at all using any of those words. What movie did you decide that we should watch?
That's right. Well, you're doing a thing where you're going to wine school. Jamie's studying. He's hitting the books. He's very confident. He's not having any crushing existential doubt right now about his future.
67 days, Scott. 67 days.
You got this. It's okay. Just think about it. This will really fuck with you. By the time this episode comes out, it'll be much less than that.
Fuck you.
And that's only like 3 weeks from now. Well, anyway, so Jamie's going to school. Jamie's hitting the books. And so that kind of put me in the mind to go back to the old film school. My time doing my undergrad in film studies. I don't even know what the hell it says on my degree anymore. But so for this 6-part miniseries, we are doing film school classics. Some of the canonized great works of the first half of the 20th century that sort of shaped the language and the politics and the aesthetic of cinema. And the ones that I feel like I saw a lot in film school and that were kind of formative for me. So last time we watched Book.
A Trip to the Moon.
That's right. Scotty. Thank you. Last time we watched
Voyage dans la Lune.
Georges Méliès' Trip to the Moon. Today we're moving into Soviet propaganda territory and we're watching Sergei Eisenstein's 1925 classic, The Battleship Potemkin.
What year was Trip to the Moon?
1902.
And so we're jumping ahead.
We're jumping ahead by a number of decades. Yeah. And a lot of things happened, you know, in the intervening times. But there weren't an enormous number of the silents that I actually saw in college, and a lot of them weren't ones that made an impact on me. But Battleship Potemkin was one I actually discovered sitting down to watch it in prep for this episode. Mm-hmm. I had never seen it before.
What?
So a weird thing in film school, especially at least my undergrad film school experience at Temple, is that unless I had a class where it was like a late night, like 3 or 4 hour screening class, we never watched anything in full unless it was a short. There wasn't enough time. So you would always see selections. So for Battleship Potemkin, I had seen the Odessa stair sequence, the very, very, very famous Odessa stair sequence as an example of montage editing theory. I probably saw that over 5 or 6 classes over the course of my extended college education. But until just a few days ago, I'd never watched the entire thing in full.
As I saw that sequence and sort of put things together, do you remember our erstwhile friend? I don't know if you still talk to Dan Higgins.
I do not. But yeah, Dan Higgins for a time had a band called Odessa Stair.
And I finally get that reference.
You understand that reference now. Yeah. The Odessa Stair. Great band name. Super dope band name.
Yeah. Really, really good band name. Anyway, before we get into tasting the wine, we had an open question from 2 episodes ago that I did not answer last episode.
Jamie, this is the first time we've ever followed up on one of those. I'm very impressed.
Well, I wanted to do it.
I don't even remember the question. What
also,
was it?
Also, I was listening to the episode. And first of all, that episode's very funny.
Well,
mostly because you were upset and I was laughing a lot and I was smiling while I was listening.
I will say, not to toot my own horn, normally I'm the funny one in the show. You're the stuffy, bookish one who gets all chuffed about
terroir
and things. Oh, you definitely are in the context of the show. But you, with a totally straight face, listing all the different flavors and breeds of cat pee, very funny. It was very funny. I saw that pop up on the gram and I got tickled all over.
Yeah, it was a good one. So the question was, why do we tilt a sparkling wine bottle as a matter of form in order to relieve the pressure?
And now,
why is that best practice?
And I believe the answer I was given when I posed the question was, that's what I was always told.
Uh-huh. That's correct.
Okay.
This is the unexamined, we just do this. So I posed the question to a number of highly qualified sommeliers that I'm friends with and that I'm studying with. And the answer that was returned to me is that it expands the surface of the wine that is exposed to air, thus letting the gas expel itself more gradually as opposed to in a quick puff, so to speak.
So because there's more surface area that's exposed to the air, more of the gas can be exposed and therefore there's less pressure upon the release of gas.
It's more of a gradual release, I think, is the answer that we've all arrived at together as wine professionals.
Well, you know what? You should ask when you go and do your master exam and just see if somebody can answer that question for you. And maybe one of them knows. My guess is none of them know.
Yeah, probably.
It's all bullshit.
Yeah,
it's all fake.
If you tilt the bottle, it explodes less often is really it's still good practice. So we've got this wine. You want to open the wine?
Yeah, let's do it. I've already cut the foil away. And this is a Vouvray. Now, Jamie, should I have chilled this bottle?
Yes, white wine generally chilled. Although, as I've said a number of times on this show, I do, like for analytic tasting, tend to prefer room temperature.
Because then the aromatics are allowed to volatilize better at room temperature.
Correct.
Yeah. You didn't think I was going to know that, but I did.
You know, at this point, Scott, it's kind of a crapshoot whether you're going to know a thing that I've taught you or not.
I think taught is a strong word, but
that I have said out loud on
multiple
a microphone.
Times. Ooh, it smells nice. A Vouvray. I like a Vouvray.
As I recall, your and your wife's housewife for quite some time was a Vouvray.
For a time, yeah. And now we think it's too sweet and we don't like it as much anymore. And I blame you for that.
Yeah, I'm willing to accept responsibility for that.
All right, so last time we thought as a way of being fun, because Jamie wants to compare this experience of all these wines to the actual experience of going through the Court of Master Sommelier's tasting grid that he'll be judged upon as a rubric when he goes out for his exam. Last time we had me go through the rubric, and I came very close to passing the bar of you have to complete a tasting in 4 minutes. I came very close.
At like 25 minutes.
I was going to say 28, but yeah, it was a long time. So we're not going to do that again. But instead, Jamie, I have your little rubric right here.
Oh boy.
And here, let me get this set up here. Need to be able to see self. We're going to set a timer.
4 minutes and 10 seconds on the clock.
4 minutes and 10 seconds is the time. Okay.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to just hold this up right here.
Okay.
And I will go through. You've got your visual notes, your nose palette notes, your structural notes, initial conclusion and conclusion notes. And I will simply prompt you with the single or two word thing here, like clarity or secondary colors. And then you will state them and we will see if you can do it in 4 minutes and 10 seconds.
Okay.
Does that seem reasonable?
Sure.
All right. And okay. Give me clarity.
This is a clear white wine.
Brightness.
Brightness has been removed from the rubric, but this is, I would say, day bright.
How about intensity?
It's got a moderate intensity.
How about color?
It is yellow with a secondary color of amber.
Ooh, okay. Meniscus.
Medium plus.
Viscosity.
Also medium plus.
All right, now we're on to nose palate. What's the condition?
The wine is clean and showing youthful.
How about the intensity?
It has a moderate intensity of aromas.
Aroma versus bouquet.
Aroma versus bouquet? What?
The example here is youthful aromas versus aged tertiary aromas. Okay,
sure,
aromas.
Yeah, it's youthful, which I already said.
Oh, my screen turned off. There we go. How about fruit?
Mostly malic fruit, apples and pears. I would say ripe to overripe Macintosh apple. It's got almost like an apple cider situation going on, not like fermented alcoholic apple cider, but like fresh Martinelli's.
All right. How about flower, herb, or other notes?
There's a big old white flower kind of situation going on here, maybe lilacs, but also there's like a chamomile tea kind of aroma.
All right. Earth.
Not much in the way of earth.
Oak.
I'll backtrack to earth really quick to address minerality, which is significant. There's like a dusty granite or limestone type minerality. And to answer the question about oak, I don't believe that this wine saw any new French oak. I believe this was stainless steel fermented and aged.
All right. Now we on to structure. What about the sweetness?
This wine lives somewhere in between dry and off dry. There is residual sugar.
All right. Body.
Medium to medium plus body.
Acidity.
Acidity is high.
Alcohol.
Alcohol is medium plus.
Tannin.
No tannin. And no phenolics either.
Complexity.
The wine is, I would say, of a moderate to moderate plus complexity.
We're going to have to come back to that one later. Length.
It's got a long finish.
Balance.
The wine is in balance.
All right. Now we're on to initial conclusions. Quality.
Oh, wow. We didn't do any of the flavor assessments on the palate.
Well, take it up with Wine Folly.
Oh, you're doing the Wine Folly one. I thought you had the CMS.
This is what you said the grid
was. It's okay. It's okay. It's okay. Initial conclusion. I believe this to be an old world wine, based on the acidity presentation and the difference from nose to palate. Possible varietals include Chenin Blanc and Riesling coming from France or Germany, in a, 2 to 5 year age range.
What about climate? Did you say anything about climate?
I said moderate climate.
Okay, great. And then conclusions, grape blend, name the grape variety.
This is a Chenin Blanc coming from France, coming from Vouvray, Grand Cru level 2017.
All right. But you didn't do that blind, right? Because you know the bottle.
Yes, I chose this one.
All right. Well, you brought it in just under the wire, mm-hmm. with 11 seconds there to go. Everybody can see Jamie in the reflection on my screen. And that's definitely not weird at all. All right. So Wine Folly's little tasting chart here is not the same as the CMS tasting chart.
It's very similar, but we skipped the entire palate assessment other than structure.
But it did sweetness, body, acidity, alcohol, tannin, complexity, length, and balance.
We didn't talk about flavors.
I talked about
aromas on the nose, and then
it's nose/palate.
Okay, you do those two separately. Nose first, then palate.
All right. So Madeline's chart really just combined your nose and your palate situation. All right. Well, that was
what I told you.
I will say her chart much more aesthetically pleasing than the one that
the wine the design on Wine Folly is excellent.
Yeah, top tier design.
Yep.
Yeah.
So I really like this wine a lot. What do you think?
It's interesting. There is like a tart apple thing going on. Very tart and yet also mealy. Can it be tart and mealy at the same time?
I think
mealy is more of a textural thing.
Yeah.
Right?
And so but I'm also like there's mealiness. A flavor, like the irrespective of the texture of a mealy apple, there's an aroma flavor component to that, like that condition of an apple.
Yeah. And there's some kind of either a dried fruit or maybe a stewed fruit thing going on that I'm getting as a, what do you call it? A retronasal thing, not necessarily a flavor, but something I'm smelling while the wine is in my mouth.
Yeah, I can get that. Almost like a dried apricot.
Yeah, a little bit. And then that bitterness that you get with a dried apricot as well.
Mm-hmm.
Just a scotch of that bitterness. There are notes to it that recall some of the less gross sherries that I've had. And I don't know if that's that same like dried fruit thing that gives me like a raisiny vibe, but definitely getting things in the ballpark of some of the sherries, despite my general disinterest in the sherries.
Your open dislike of sherry. You seem to be on the fence.
No, I like it. I think I generally like it because it has the presence of fruit and there is a scotch of sugar.
Yep.
And you, what did you say? You said this was between off dry and dry?
Yeah.
But not bone dry?
Not bone dry.
Yeah.
And certainly not. It's there is perceptible residual sugar here.
And remind me, the distinction between sugar and residual sugar is the residual is the leftover after fermentation.
Correct.
Is that the idea?
Yep.
And how do we differentiate that from just sugar? Because isn't any sugar that's left over after fermentation, unless it's added sugar?
Unless it's added sugar.
Okay.
Right. And it is not in this case.
Have you ever given me anything that had added sugar? I feel like that goes against your ethos, added sugar.
I don't
sugar.
Think so. For sure, you know, a small handful of the wines that have come on this show had like sugar added prior to fermentation, a process called chaptalization, which isn't about adding sweetness, but about getting a higher alcohol. Maybe the grapes came in a little bit less ripe and the winemaker wants to make sure that the fermentation is maybe a little bit more healthy and robust, or they're looking for simply a higher alcohol percentage. So that happens from time to time in the wine world. It's not a thing that I concern myself with too much, unless it's just like there to cover up poor farming, bad grapes.
Hmm. Yeah, I think I'm on board. I'm having a hard time placing any of the nasal notes, though.
You don't, do you get any, like, I get a strong chamomile aroma on this wine. And it's very much present on the palate.
Chamomile on the palate.
Do you drink much chamomile?
I do. We call it soothing cham in my house because it's nighttime sleepy tea. Ain't no caffeine at all. We get some soothing cham. It's bedtime tea.
You fucking people.
After we put the child to bed, wife comes downstairs. I'm like, do you want some tea? And she's like, yeah. And I'm like, do you want some chai? I normally have a chai after the kid goes to bed because I want like a scotch of caffeine, just like a scotch to get me through whatever I'm going to throw on after bedtime.
Yep.
For the movie watching, but she'll normally want a soothing cham. Although I recently did get caffeine-free chai because I'm getting old and any caffeine after like 5 o'clock just fucks my night's sleep.
Why are our bodies so bad after 30? It's just like everything is entropy. Fucked.
And it's accelerating. It's really accelerating.
I hate
it
so much.
It's not good. It's poor. I'm very alarmed. I don't really like it. I guess I'm getting a chamomile note. Normally for me, chamomile is I guess some of the notes are kind of muddied by an abundance of honey and a little bit of dairy. I don't really drink a lot of straight soothing cham.
You put dairy in your chamomile?
Just a little splash of milk. I like milk in my tea.
Very interesting.
Just a little splash of milk in my tea.
I've never heard of that.
I'm Jamie. I just take my tea straight. I don't like anything in my tea. Same as my coffee. I like it to taste bad.
I like it to taste like what it tastes like.
Yeah, but what if it could taste better than that? With the addition of, like, sugar and also maybe a scotch of dairy.
But also, speaking of the entropy of our bodies, that dairy fucks me up, dude.
Yeah, I'm good to go on the dairy front.
Not good.
Lots of dairy intake up in here. No digestive issues whatsoever. It's
one of
great.
These days, Scott, you're going to have explosive diarrhea as a result of some dairy intake. And
I don't know, man. Maybe I'm not. Not all of our bodies are the same. Okay, maybe. Maybe dairy's never gonna fuck me up. I've always had a high dairy intake, which has created other problems with my body. But like digestively, me and dairy, we're good to go. I'm gonna go have some yogurt and a block of cheese after this.
You better check it before you wreck it, homie, is all I'm saying.
No, I do have to scale back my cheese intake. Yeah, it's numbs. I like it. It's a little crisp. I like the mouth feel. I forget what you said, but this is at least a medium plus on the body, right?
Yeah.
This is a nice
exactly
mouth
what
coating
I said.
Situation.
Yeah, it's a robust wine. It's at once, it's like a little bit easy and thirst quenching, but also has like breadth and body and interest. This is one of those wines that I feel like can kind of do anything. It's good with most food. It's good for most circumstances. And it's good young and also old.
What is old? This is 2017. This is at least older than most of the wines that I've had.
Yeah, this is a five and change year old wine.
Is that old or is that?
That's old for some wines, but it's not even close to old for this wine.
How old can this go?
Well, in 2017, I had a bottle of 1985. Domaine Huet, actually exactly this bottling, the Demi-Sec Le Mont, which was showing extraordinary. It was so youthful. And it's an interesting thing that happens with wine that has sugar as it ages. The perception of it goes drier and drier the older it gets. What's been told to me as reasoning for that is that the sugars form longer chain molecules, and so your perception of the sweetness goes down. Polysaccharides, Scotty.
Yeah, giving me the chemistry term for it, not helping.
I knew that wouldn't be helpful, which is why I said it.
So it becomes drier because over time the sugars form longer chain molecules,
which are perceived as less sweet than the like monosaccharides or disaccharides.
And is this like a surface area thing or just
no, it's just like the receptors on your tongue,
because the receptors
are built
don't
for
perceive as much because the things are bigger, and so they're not receiving as many of the sugars because they're not getting touched by as many little sugars that they're designed to touch.
Essentially, yes. Good job sussing that one out.
Right? Man, I'm going to be helpful with my kids' homework until like high school science, and then talk to mom. I ain't got shit for you, bud.
Yep.
I got nothing to help you out with. Really, high school, anything.
You'll be really great helping him out with macroeconomics.
No.
As we've mentioned previously
I'll be fine.
On the show.
Although he's going to be fine by high school English. He's got more media literacy than like a lot of adults that I know. So yeah, this is numbers. If I had any complaint about it, it is that the color is like,
it's a little bit like you're waking up hungover. It's got a pee-pee color.
Right. Yeah. It's got a, I'm dehydrated and I might need to call my urologist color. Yeah.
Yes. Correct.
Yeah, it's like, did I drink too much last night, or is this an early sign of a kidney stone kind of a color? Ooh.
Well, you know, white wine, as it ages, takes on a little bit more color. Red wine loses color. But also Chenin Blanc in general, when it, you know, gets to a certain amount of ripeness, has more color than other grapes like Pinot Grigio or Riesling or whatever have you.
Is there a reason for that? Is it the skins?
It's the skins, yeah.
It's the skins. The mm-hmm. Shannon skins have more color than the other skins.
That's right.
The Pinot Gris skins and the like.
Well, Pinot Gris was a bad example. We'll say like Riesling and Chardonnay and Grüner.
Chardonnay. Okay.
Yeah.
And those are the four white grapes.
Those are the only four. That's correct.
Right. Well, except for Pinot Gris. So it's five. There's five.
There's five.
Right. All right. Well, what things do you have to say about this wine? Because I'm enjoying it.
I'm glad you're liking it.
It's very numbs. It didn't hose me at all. There's nothing particularly weird about it except for this pea color. Yeah, I'm getting down on it.
So this is one of those wines that, like I said in the last episode about how I was going to, you know, talk a little bit about some of my complaints with the CMS curriculum. Uh-oh. And also the things that I've found to be useful. And, you know, I don't as much have a complaint with this wine being a part of the curriculum, and I don't really have a complaint with Chenin Blanc in general. Like it's been taken as like a Sami grape. It's one of the things that if you ask a Sam, like, what do they love to drink? It's in the top three along with champagne and Riesling, as things that we generally like to drink because they're high acid and they're sort of vivacious. And I also don't think that this wine has been priced beyond what it's worth in the same way that Burgundy and Bordeaux and Napa Cabernet have. And it's generally pretty accessible. You know, a Vouvray, even like this is the top end Vouvray. This is the best one. And it's $40. Your financial investment to learn a bunch about Vouvray is not huge. But also the gulf between the best and the worst is a lot smaller. I think that your old house wine, the Barton and Goustier Vouvray, is a really nice wine at its price. You know, it's like a $13 bottle these days.
Yeah, it's a pretty dope price for a bottle of wine.
And it's easily drinkable. You know, it doesn't have a ton of like texture or breadth, and I don't think it would age particularly well, but like grab a bottle, drink a bottle. It's nice. It's an easy one to have on hand.
Nice cooking wine too.
Good cooking wine.
Not too sweet to put in as like a deglaze for a pan sauce or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's versatile. I was just saying that like the gulf between entry level and top end Vouvray is not as wide as entry level Bordeaux and like first growth Bordeaux or entry level Burgundy and Grand Cru Burgundy, or the same in Napa Valley, where the price points reflect a wide gulf, but also the quality does.
Okay, so it's not just people pricing shit because they can. It's because it is that much better.
It's because it is better. It's maybe not that much better. Like if you're right, okay. Like you can get a bottle of entry level Bordeaux for $10. But a top end Bordeaux could run you $5,000 to $10,000. Now, is that
that's
bottle?
A lot.
That's a fucking lot.
That's a lot. That's like a shitty used car.
Right. Hey, hey, my used car is not shitty and it cost around that.
All right. Well, the last car I bought before the car I'm currently driving, the last car I bought like solely with my own money, I think I spent maybe $4,000 on that car, and Rusty Tears was a piece of shit.
Rusty Tears.
Rusty Tears.
I remember Rusty Tears.
Rusty Tears had a good long run.
Sure did.
Long, sad, Rusty Tears running down his headlights. Rusty Tears.
Oh, man, because the hood was all rusted out.
Boy, we have been off topic for
very
a
much
while.
Off topic.
Hang on, I'm scrolling through your notes here, something about a German POW camp.
Yeah, so the winery, before we get to the history of the wine, just really quickly, I love these wines. They've been special to me. Obviously, I had a birth vintage for a birthday, and I thought it was great, and this is one of those wines that's sort of given me perspective on what Chenin Blanc can and maybe should be. You know, it's about texture. It can handle a little bit of sugar, but can also be bone dry. I think that centering this wine is helpful for understanding the grape. As I've tasted a bunch of Chenin Blancs from other regions, you know, while I was on vacation in Austin, I had a Chenin Blanc from Valle de Guadalupe in Mexico, a Mexican Chenin Blanc, which was really stunning, but a totally different expression. Understanding this wine helped me put that wine in context, if that makes sense. Like I was able to sort of identify the Chenin Blanc markers about it and identify the things that were maybe winemaking decisions and also climate and soil about it. You know, it had the texture, it had the flavors. It was certainly depressed as far as acidity is concerned because it comes from such a hot, hot climate. And also the fruit character of it was a little bit elevated and there was maybe less minerality owing to that climate. But it was still bone dry. So I think that centering this wine has been largely helpful to me. You know,
I'm sensing a huge butt.
No, I don't really have a butt other than
sorry.
I've got a big old butt.
Hey, he's got a big old butt, Dick.
Why are you like this?
You just said I don't really have a butt. And I just imagine that out of context as being very funny to me. Like that could be like my new ringtone whenever Jamie texts me. It's just I don't really have a butt. All right. I'm sorry. You don't have a butt. Please continue.
Other than the butt that I do have is that it's sort of a...
So tell me about the butt that you have.
The butt that I do have, Scott, is that it remains a part of this wider narrative in the wine world that there is, maybe that there should be a defining style or a benchmark wine that I think in other regions does either the region or the grape or the winemakers a disservice. I think that centering this wine gives us context, but centering Chateau Lafite excludes a lot of people from an understanding of what Bordeaux is and can be. I think that centering Screaming Eagle does a disservice to a lot of people trying to learn what Cabernet is and should and can be. And I think a lot of that is economically driven, but having this example is just another step, I guess, in that narrative that these benchmark wines are the like be all end all of understanding what a grape and or a region can and or should be.
So your beef with the centering is about CMS. CMS is centering this wine.
Yes.
Okay. When are there a lot of Chenins that they pick that are on your, like how many wines are part of the curriculum that you have to be familiar with and that you might be tested on?
Not that many.
How many?
A couple hundred.
Okay.
Yeah. But there are thousands and thousands of wines out there that we could make an argument are as valuable. But these are the wines that maybe got distribution in the U.S. first or have a certain amount of prestige among wealthy people, that sort of eclipse the other ones. And I don't think that is right. And I think that for an organization that on its masthead says represents the global excellence in beverage, maybe we should have a broader understanding of these things.
That seems reasonable.
Thank
but
you.
It also sounds like you're saying that the CMS folks should be testing you on more wines.
I do. That, yeah.
But Jamie, you've only got 67 days.
I know, Scott. Yes. So my argument is that this test should be harder. And it's already like one of the hardest exams in the world.
Like they got to narrow it down, right? It's like math, right? Like I know it's a bad example, but like when you do a math test, they don't give you every possible mathematic equation that you could possibly be tested upon. They give you examples that test your skills in different ways.
Right.
Now, this is different because of, like you're saying, with the centering, but like they got to narrow it down somewhere.
They do.
Is your beef that it's too narrow or that the things that this is a softball. I'm setting you right up here. Get ready to just knock this fucker out of the park, Jamie.
You got it.
Your beef is that the things that they are narrowing it down to are not representative of the world of wine.
Correct. Yes.
They're too selective and too Western oriented.
And by centering them, it places in the minds of, you know, young professionals who are going through these exams that these are the wines that they should purchase for their programs. So it also does economic damage to other smaller producers that are maybe different.
So hypothetically, and I got no dog in this race. I don't care.
It has been made clear on right. this podcast.
So. I just wanted to be just out there.
Just want to make sure that everyone knows.
Not invested.
Don't give a shit.
Not to say that I'm cynical about it, but like devil's advocating here, for the devil. If they centered, if they had a complete turnabout and they started centering wines that are the diametric opposite of this one, wines that are a different flavor profile or from smaller producers, would that not then be centering something else that is equally unrepresentative right. of the types of things that this varietal could be?
As I've already said, my argument isn't that they should be centering different things. My argument is that they should be centering more things, a broader representation of the things that can come from an area or a grape, and maybe worry about some of the like hyper nerdy specifics that could only be useful to a winemaker in that region. Like statistics like what's the minimum amount of residual sugar for demi-sec Vouvray. Maybe we don't need to know that. Maybe that's less important than a breadth of knowledge of the producers on the ground and the variability in style.
Well, how do they test you on that, Jamie? How does that come down to a standardized Scantron test that you have to fill out?
Well, there's no Scantron. It's just there are some multiple choice things on the certified and advanced exams, but at the MS level, it's all verbal. And so all of it can be nuance. Like there's room for it just in the methodology of the exam. I think that the like systematic aversion to nuance is the problem.
Look, again, not particularly invested.
Yeah.
But I feel like your critique is just opening up the exam to all kinds of other problems. Like sure. you
but
say
like, let's
that,
solve those problems.
But no, but
like,
you're
why would we rest on this one problem because of the possibility that we might have to deal with more? Like, let's grow and evolve and be dynamic. I don't see any value in staying static, especially when that means, you know, doing a disservice to innovators in regions. And doing a disservice to the sommeliers who study these things, who, you know, maybe are interested in other styles, other wines, or even other beverages. I don't know. I think that there's room for nuance and that maybe there could be an effort made to bring in other points of view.
Yeah. But then your thing is also about the economics of it.
Yeah.
And like if they're broadening. Sure, but also the people being tested could get hurt. If suddenly the list of curricula approved wines that you could be tested on like doubled or tripled, then that's even more shit that you got to taste, dog, which means it's more bottles that you and your friends got to buy and do tastings on, which yeah. means for the person being tested, the number of things that you have to try becomes exponentially more expensive.
Yeah, it's true.
So I'm saying, me advocating for nuance here,
Yeah.
Maybe it's a little more complicated than just your Jamie-centric worldview. Maybe
it's very complicated, and I would like the discussion to continue inside of the CMS and outside of it. Because once again, if this organization is the representation of global excellence in the beverage industry.
And it seems that it is, based on what I've heard from you.
Based on what they say on the masthead of their website. Then maybe we should have a higher level of expertise, and maybe the things that are important, or rather maybe the things that are important for us to study currently are not broadly important, as the example of minimum residual sugar for demi-sec Chenin Blanc in Vouvray. That's not important. I'm never going to use that on the floor of a restaurant, and certainly no guest in a restaurant or wine consumer is at all interested in that statistic. It's useful to a winemaker in Vouvray, period. So maybe we could delete that from the curriculum and talk about other styles, maybe the way that making Chenin Blanc has changed since the Second World War, or since the natural wine movement came about, or, you know, talk about industrial farming, talk about regenerative agriculture. Just a couple of things that maybe we could test on.
It seems to me
that I'm pushing a narrative, that I have an agenda. Yes.
I mean, that goes without saying. Yes. No, it seems to me that this must be a very frustrating experience for you.
It is.
As it doesn't actually seem like you're valuing a lot of the knowledge that you are required to absorb to gain this accreditation or this documentation of your skills that you will ultimately not actually put to use.
That is correct.
Okay, great.
Yeah, the reason
that's a bummer,
why
man.
The reason why I'm continuing on this path, the reason why there are a couple of reasons, but maybe the two big ones, why I'm continuing on this path.
Money.
No, that's the third reason. The first is I have a complex about wanting to like change the world, right? Like as a youngin, I always thought that I would do something big, and that those expectations have ratcheted down significantly. But this is one area where I think that maybe I could swing things for the better with inside my small industry, by becoming a master sommelier, getting elected to the board of directors, and helping to change the way we talk about wine going forward. Because I do believe that CMS is going to be powerful whether or not I'm a part of it. So if I'm a part of it, at least I can make it a little bit better. The second reason is like, I've gone this fucking far. I might as well take it over the fucking finish line.
I mean, that's the sunk cost fallacy. That's not a real thing. Okay.
But it's a real thing in my mind.
Well, but maybe you should talk about that with your therapist.
And I do. It's
really,
subject-
you talk about the sunk cost fallacy with your therapist?
Yes.
All right. Well, I feel bad about being glib then about it. Anyway.
And then the third reason is, even as he's making the universal sign for money.
You gotta make it rain, Jamie. I have a single bit of U.S. currency on the table here. That wouldn't really be making it rain.
It would not.
No, even though it's a hunch, but no.
No. Master sommeliers can expect a higher salary. However, I work for myself. But even my consulting business is likely to improve if I have that fucking red pin, just from people seeing that I'm a master sommelier offering consulting services. I'm likely to see an increase in sales and in the price point that I'm able to sell.
Well, then I applaud this, and I think you should keep it up and you should stop complaining about it, because if you're going to be part of the system, then you're part of the problem, and you can't complain when you're part of the problem.
No, I'm trying to change the system, Scott. God damn it.
I just wanted you to say that you were going to change the system again. So thank you.
You're a dick. I hate you so much. Why do I even do this?
You have a revolutionary spirit, Jamie. You're gonna tear down these walls.
All right. I'm done talking about this wine.
Really?
Yes. I feel like
you just started. You have all these things written down here. Are there really nothing else you wanted to say?
I mean, we could like go through the rote stuff about the winery having been founded in 1928 and one of the owners having been in World War II POW camps, as you mentioned earlier. But really the important part is the important part as it relates to our discussion is that this wine is considered to be the benchmark for what Chenin Blanc is, can, should be. And while I do agree with that, because I've tasted this wine a lot and I really like it, I do think that centering single producers is problematic, generally speaking. And that is the conclusion of what I wanted to say as it relates to this mini series on the CMS curriculum.
All right. Well, we're going to go from speaking about one iconoclastic revolutionary to another. and for movie times today, we are talking about Sergei Eisenstein and Battleship Potemkin. So this is one of the most formally significant movies like ever made, to say nothing of its political importance.
What do you mean by formally significant?
Formally, like, as it
pertains to its form?
Its form, its aesthetic. It popularized and was a landmark example of an intellectual school of editing that came out of the Soviet film world that is like still influential today.
So it's not important due to its formality, like it's not wearing a tux or something.
No, it's not. It's not a fancy boy movie, Jamie. Okay, the form over the function. Don't make me mute you. All right.
You won't fucking do it.
Don't tempt me, buddy. Don't tempt me.
All right, go on. It's formally important.
It's formally significant. Battleship Potemkin, co-written and directed by then 27-year-old Sergei Eisenstein. It was made in 1925. It was commissioned by the Soviet Central Committee to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the failed First Russian Revolution. The movie dramatizes the mutiny of the crew of the Battleship Potemkin and the brutal response of the Tsar's troops against the civilian population of Odessa who supported them. The movie's most famous sequence is one of the most famous sequences in all of cinema when the Tsar's troops come marching down the enormous Odessa stairs and gun down a panicked crowd of innocent fleeing people, culminating in the iconic imagery of a baby carriage bouncing down the stairs over like dead bodies and dodging gunfire. Truly, the movie's legacy can't really be understated. The imagery of the Odessa step sequence is genuinely and without exaggeration and not using it in this like diminished contemporary way, actually iconic. It's been referenced in dozens of other films, probably most famously in Brian De Palma's The Untouchables in 1986. But even as recently as like Dune, the Denis Villeneuve Dune Part 1 has shots that feel very evocative of the soldiers on the Great Staircase.
The Untouchables was 86?
I believe that is correct, yes.
Jesus.
The movie ranked in the top 10 of the Decennial Sight and Sound Critics Top 100 list from 1952 until 2002, and even in the most recent poll, the 2022 critics list, it still ranks as 54th most important film of all time or greatest film of all time.
When did the Sight and Sound thing get started?
1952 was the first year.
Okay.
So from the year.
From the inception.
Yeah, until... for the first six lists that they put together, it was in the top 10 movies of all time.
Wild.
Its power to inspire revolutionary zeal has been feared by governments worldwide. The movie was banned at times over the 20th century by the United States, by the United Kingdom, where it was, I think, the longest banned movie in UK censorship history. It was banned in France and,
funny enough,
in an amazing twist of fate, it was also banned in the USSR. once Stalin became terrified of like mutinies and uprisings against his autocratic regime. Who knew? As I said at the top of the episode, I saw the Odessa stair sequence in probably every film class I had for the first few years, like in all of the like introductory, like 101 film classes, everybody would have to talk about montage editing and Soviet editing theories. And they would show the Odessa stair sequence from this film. But I had never actually seen the entire thing until recently. I really thought I had. Before we get to whatever Jamie has to say about it, I'm coming in with a hot take, and I'm going to say Battleship Potemkin's a real good movie. It's like super good and very compelling. Enough for me. Jamie, what did you think of Sergei Eisenstein's Battleship Potemkin?
Well, first of all, speaking of the Odessa stair sequence, the moment where the mother is carrying the badly hurt child up toward the Tsar's troops, and you can see their shadows on the steps, yep. And the camera's like moving backwards.
Chilling.
Truly chilling, and that's an image that will stick in my mind for an awful long time.
Well, because you just know that they're going to open up on her.
Yep.
And then that poor kid gets trampled. The kid is already trampled.
The kid is already trampled at that point. Yeah.
God, it's
awful. She's just begging. She's like, my child is badly hurt. Can you please stop? And of course they don't stop. Fucking rough. It's
fuck
rough
your kid, stuff. Lady.
But just the image, not even the context, just the movement of her walking towards them, the camera moving back to reveal their shadows getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Powerful stuff.
Yeah.
Extremely powerful stuff.
Very effective propaganda.
Also, Dr. Smirnov.
Mm-hmm.
Who I noted because his name is Smirnov. Fuck that guy. I wish we had like a moment of watching him die.
We don't see him die. I believe he is one of the officers who gets hopped off the ship into the ocean, if I'm not
mistaken.
For sure,
but we don't get like a close-up of like a brutal death, because this motherfucker like is looking another human being in the face in front of rotting meat and going, those aren't maggots, when they clearly are maggots.
Yeah, he says, just put it in some brine. It'll all be fine. They're not maggots.
That motherfucker first against the wall.
They're tiny fly eggs, which I believe turn into maggots. All right, so I see the direction this is going. I wasn't sure if Jamie was going to come in here and be like, oh, propaganda's terrible, and I don't like propaganda, and this is bad, or... So here's the take, line them up against the wall.
It's both. Because it is obviously propaganda. It does not allow for really any ambiguity. Like the officers are uniformly bad. The Tsar's troops in Odessa are literally faceless. We don't see a close up on any of them. And we are made to sympathize with the people, our brothers, our comrades, whatever. Also, kill them all, eat the rich, like let's have a revolution.
There it is. Okay. There it is. That sounds more like it.
It's both, right? Like, of course I think that there should be more nuance, but did I enjoy watching the sailors mutiny? You goddamn right I did. After they put a tarp over these guys and are threatening to shoot them, and the guy shouts out, brothers, who are you shooting? Yeah, and then they take over the ship and they throw all the fucking officers overboard. Like, yes, fuck them.
It's very powerful, Jamie.
Fuck
you. You are an excellent sheep.
Fuck you,
are
buddy.
You are being herded very well. I'm impressed by you. No, but seriously, it is. It's very powerful. It's very like evocative. That's Eisenstein was like a very political filmmaker. He like obviously he's making like political movies. This was not his only movie about Russian revolutions. A few years later, he made something also commissioned by the state to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the successful, like, Lenin-led 1917 revolution. But even his use of editing was political. For him, it was not about centering individuals. It was about centering the crowd and centering the sense of scale of hundreds of people and about creating a sense of community and communal uprising against a faceless oppressing force.
We only got the name really for one character, and he's the guy who dies.
Yeah.
Valinchuk.
Valinchuk sounds about right. Yeah.
He's the one who he gives a little manifesto while they're in their horrible sleeping conditions, getting beaten by the watch officer who just sucks. And then he, you know, makes his valiant stand as the men are about to be shot on the quarterdeck.
It would be the character is Grigory Vakulinchuk.
Vakulinchuk.
Who I will say, and this is partly like, and maybe not an intentional thing, but I really felt like he came back from the dead at the end of the movie and was encouraging the soldiers on when they had to like ride out against the fleet of the Tsar's ships. And I think it's just because like it's a lot of like burly mustachioed white Russian dudes. And it was a little hard for me to differentiate them a little bit. And I truly thought like, is this another appearance of ghosts in the movies? But no, I think it's just me.
It's just another
hard time telling them apart. Yeah.
Burly Russian man.
There are several shots where it's exclusively burly mustachioed Russian sailors, and it's pretty hard to separate them.
It is.
Yeah.
We don't want to say that they all look the same, but they kind of all look the same.
Well, in this particular example, they all sort of look the same.
And maybe isn't that on purpose?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not a movie that emphasizes the individual. And when an individual is emphasized, it's only as like an avatar for the community.
Right. They put his body on display with a sign that said, "For a spoonful of borscht."
Yeah.
With this candle, and the women cry and the men are, you know, called to action. And I found this movie to be incredibly powerful.
It's super evocative. It's crazy powerful. There's a reason why like authoritarians have been terrified of this movie for fucking decades, including the country that commissioned its very existence.
And the one that we currently live in.
It did have a premiere in the U.S. Hollywood legends, Mary Pickford and, what's his name? Why can't I think of his name? I was just reading about him in a book last night. Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks, who were like Hollywood royalty in the mid-20s. They had traveled to the Soviet Union and saw the movie, and they convinced Eisenstein to like have a print shipped to the U.S. And a year after it had its December 1925 premiere in the Soviet Union, it had a domestic premiere, and I think it was in New York City. And then not long after that, the movie was banned because, you know, we were afraid of the Reds, and you can't show this kind of shit.
It also feels kind of this moment right now, you know, with a lot of
thing,
people
right?
on yeah. our side of the aisle, you know, calling, you know, eat the rich.
It's
break
it's
the system
very
down.
Easy to project a modern sensibility onto a movie that has fucking armed troops gunning down people who are peacefully protesting.
Yep.
Yeah. It's for something that is so specific in its political point of view and the like political moment and the place that it's trying to evoke. It like there's a reason it's got power, and it's because that kind of imagery, for whatever reason, always seems to take root in people's hearts about like, man, fuck you. Stop shooting people. Stop creating a panic with all of us and making us trample a small child.
And stop making us eat maggoty fucking meat.
We ain't had nothing but maggoty bread for 3 stinking days.
Yeah. Why can't we have some meat?
Meat's back on the menu, boys. Oh man, it's all Lord of the Rings now on the show. After Jamie and I recently watched the Lord of the Rings, and now I'm into the Two Towers and in the reading of them, and it's just I'm thinking about those rings all the time.
I definitely
my ring cycle
as
fuck you, Wagner.
When we saw the maggots, immediately like the maggoty piece of meat hanging there, and they're like, we're not going to eat this immediately. My thought was, we ain't have nothing but maggoty bread. It's just in there. There's nothing I can do about it.
We're just
but
just
imagine if the orcs had a revolution over the maggoty bread?
I mean, that would be a hell of a thing. But we can't get into that. We can't get into the racial essentialism of Tolkien, all right?
Can't we?
No, not on this recording, Jamie.
Okay, sure.
You save those blistering hot takes for when we eventually do the Rings movies. Or, I don't know, the fucking Hobbit or something.
Oh, can we not do the Hobbit?
No, but I do have to watch them at some point. But yeah, so the reason that, like, this movie is so essential in the old film school education is less for its politics and more about the importance of its editing. So Eisenstein was a student of this Soviet school of editing that favored montage. And when they're talking about montage, it's not just like even Rocky had a montage, like a training montage, although that certainly derives from it. It comes out of the Kuleshov school of film theory, which places the emphasis and the power of the language of the medium on the cut, and emphasizing the importance of montage editing over continuity editing.
So, two questions.
Yes.
Well, three, actually.
Yes.
What is Kuleshov?
Okay.
I guess only two questions. And then what, because you explained what montage editing is. What is continuity editing?
Well, I didn't fully explain montage. But so Kuleshov was this Russian film theorist I feel like we've talked about it on the show before. But the Kuleshov effect.
I have
effect,
no recollection. None at all.
That's fine. That's a very rude thing to say, and I would never say that to you, but that's fine. The thing that Kuleshov is most known for in his teachings about montage is what we now call the Kuleshov effect, which is this idea that if you place an image of a person, like a close up on a person with a completely blank expression, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe for the socials or whatever, I'll do this in the video editing with just this very neutral blank face that Jamie is making right now. But if we cut from this shot of Jamie right now with his mouth agape and, like, you know, spittle drying on his lip, and then we cut to a shot of a grilled cheese sandwich, the intellectual jump that your brain makes is Jamie is hungry. But if I take
am,
the
by
exact,
the way, I'm hungry.
Right. But if I take the exact same blank, neutral, cow-eyed expression on Jamie and then cut to, like, a sinewy, scantily clad person, then the intellectual jump is Jamie is horny.
And I'm also horny.
Right. Of
both.
Course. Wonderful. And if we cut to an image of a dead body, then Jamie is mourning. And if we cut to...
I'm not mourning.
Right. And if we cut to an image of somebody with a weapon, then maybe Jamie is frightened or Jamie is enraged. And so it's all about that for Kuleshov, and then for the Soviet followers of his school of thought, it was that cutting between things is a way to create new ideas, and that cutting is more important than, or using cutting and editing to create new ideas is more important and more powerful than what had already become sort of like the Western convention, even in the early 20s, which was using editing in what's now called continuity editing, which is this semi-invisible style of editing that emphasizes narrative clarity and emotion and performance, and kind of roots film in more of an extension of the theatrical tradition, instead of using montage, which is something that is so unique to cinema, and using it to create new language and new ideas that you could otherwise never create. There's like all different kinds of montage. I'll like quickly skim through them. Eisenstein had a series of essays. He was as much of an academic about this as he was like a practitioner of it.
I was going to say, is he a filmmaker also?
Yeah. I mean, Kuleshov was a filmmaker. Eisenstein was a filmmaker, but also wrote about it a ton and was a theorist for what you could use it for. But in one of his like landmark essays, Eisenstein kind of laid out the five key methods of montage. So there's, and all of them are present in this movie to one degree or another. So metric montage is, you think about cutting in the same way that you think about the meter in music. So you cut every 10 frames or you cut every 25 frames, but it's you're cutting regardless of what's on the screen or within the shot, you're cutting, and that creates a rhythm, right? There's rhythmic montage, which is cutting based on what is actually happening in the screen. And there's a ton of rhythmic montage in this movie. Like the Odessa stair sequence is a huge example of rhythmic montage, where the rhythm comes from the ba-dump, ba-dump, ba-dump of the baby carriage going down the stairs. And then right. We cut to the soldier's footsteps and ba-bum, ba-bum, ba-bum. Like you follow the rhythm of the action and you create a new rhythm through juxtaposition. There's tonal montage, which tonal is sort of a confusing term there, but it's more about the emotional associations of two different images when you cut them together. So like a really famous example of that, this is tonal and like a little bit intellectual montage, but you've never seen Lawrence of Arabia, right?
I never seen that Larry.
Okay. Well, so Larry in the movie, one of the most famous jump cuts of all time, and a jump cut is cutting from, it's more of a Western term because a jump cut defies continuity editing because it's not about narrative and invisibility and making it easy to understand. It's about creating new ideas. But there's a jump cut in Lawrence of Arabia where after Larry shows off his signature trick where he squeezes out a lit match between his fingertips and one of his other officers is like, "But Lawrence, why do you do that? How does it hurt so much?" They don't really sound like that, but they're British and I don't have good British accents. And Peter O'Toole holds up another match and he says, "The trick, William Potter, is not minding that it hurts." And then he blows out the match. And the second the match goes out, cut to the desert and the sun is now rising over the horizon. And so the linkage there is the heat, is not minding the heat, not minding the burn. And through that cut, we also create this idea of foreshadowing where, like Lawrence says, he doesn't mind that it burns. You don't mind that it hurts. But motherfucker, you just talked yourself into a desert posting. Let's see how your pasty British ass is going to deal with that. The intellectual montage, this comes out of the tonal montage. And it's the idea of creating a new idea through the juxtaposition of two shots. So like a super famous example of that is in 2001. I know you've seen 2001,
A Space Odyssey. A number of times.
Right. So at the end of the Dawn of Man sequence, where the ape who has just used a bone, like the first tool, the first weapon that a human's ever created to beat to death one of his enemies, and he's cheering, and in the Thus Spake Zarathustra, the Strauss is playing, and he's smashing the skulls with it, and then he hups the bone up into the air, and the camera is lifting up to find the bone. And the bone starts tumbling down, and then there's a match cut of the bone in frame exactly like this, cut 20,000 years into the future, and now there's a space platform, a spaceship that's floating in orbit in the same image there.
And it's a good cut.
It's an amazing cut. It's one of the greatest of all time, and I find it very chilling because I find it negating of every bit of human accomplishment and experience that happened in between.
Like, we don't have to analyze Kubrick right now.
That's what we're talking about. We're talking about the intellectual montage. So like, right. It's a bit of an example of tonal montage, only if you understand something that I had never understood, that the spaceship is meant to be a space-bound, like, laser or missile launching platform. So you're cutting from the first weapon to a contemporary to an
advanced weapon. Right.
But if you don't understand that, and it doesn't look like a weapon necessarily, it becomes about tools, and it's nothing that happened between the first murder and the first use of a tool or a weapon and now has mattered on the journey of the human evolution. Like, nothing has mattered in between then, and those two images separately do not have that idea at all. And it's only in the cut that the audience has that idea put into their head, that idea of negation, that idea of progress being, that was the first most important thing. Here's the second most important thing. And all of human history in between, we can just skip over that. We can just cut right past it. It doesn't matter. and then Eisenstein, in his theory, the last type of montage is overtonal, which is the combination of all of them, the combination of the metric and the rhythmic and the tonal and the intellectual to create an even more complex effect. And that you see in the Odessa sequence, where part of it is cut metrically, cutting just based on a certain number of frames. Part of it is cutting based on the movement and finding rhythm within the movement within a shot and then continuing or altering that rhythm into the next shot. And some of it is about linking two ideas together, like the baby carriage. And then we cut to like an unrelated woman looking across the stairs and screaming out and upset about it. or even there's intellectual connections that you make in there where like we cut from the poor guy with no legs who's trying to escape, and then we cut to the feet of the soldiers. And it's the powerful against the powerless. And now we think, well, maybe all of them are basically the guy with no legs. None of them have that level of power to stand up to it. And he's doing all of these things in like this one, like show-stopping, astonishing sequence. And that's why this thing has been referenced countless times. That's why it's been taught in like basically every film school worth a damn. And that's why it fucking stands up. And that's why nearly 100 years later, you, a fucking Philistine about these things,
fuck
are
you.
Like ready to rally to the cause and line those motherfuckers up against the wall because it's so powerful.
First of all, I already was ready to rally to the cause. Like, sure. I am predisposed to this fucking idea.
That is true.
Right? Like, eat the rich is in my vocabulary. I am for redistributing wealth and like all of these ideas I am predisposed to. And also, I very much identified, obviously, with the side of this that I'm supposed to identify with. I was in it from the beginning with this movie. For a movie whose vocabulary is so different from what we see these days, right? It's a silent film, and it's very, you know, it lingers on decisions for a really long time. The dialogue is extraordinarily sparse. It's about feeling and mood more than it is about like a narrative, but it still had me locked in just fucking immediately.
Yeah.
These people, it's very obvious from the start, even just from the imagery of them in their hammocks below decks, the like overcrowded sleeping quarters. You're like, these people are being mistreated just immediately. And I wonder what happens next. And then the watch officer that just randomly hits the young guy and he like rolls over and cries about it. You're just like, yeah, fuck that guy. Throw him overboard. Kill him.
It is very effective. And a lot of that effectiveness comes out of the use of montage. You know what I find is a really thrilling sequence? And then I want to come back to something that you said, because you mentioned about silent films. Is the sequence at the end after the massacre on the Odessa stairs, and after the crew of the battleship Potemkin like shells the city essentially and like tries to blow up whatever like palace it is where the military commanders were headquarters, and then the Tsar's fleet comes in, and there's this amazing montage sequence of the crew getting the ship ready to go out and like go between all the other ships and just hope to fuck that they don't get blown to pieces. And we cut from the deckhands and the leaders of the mutiny, and we keep cutting back to the flag that's flying over the ship, which in a black and white film we can't really tell. It's meant to be the red flag, the red flag of the revolutionaries, the red right. flag of what will become the Soviets, which apparently Eisenstein in very select screenings in the beginning had hand colored to be a red flag. Well, because I think when they originally filmed it, like in that type of film process, a red flag just looked black on screen. So like that mm-hmm. didn't really work. And then we see in the bowels of the ship and the moving of the machinery. And then we cut to the waves splashing up on the sides of it and just constantly moving through it and creating this tension and these rhythms that it is so incredibly thrilling, even though it borders on abstract after a while. Like, we're not following characters, we're not following story. It's just imagery and motion and intercutting and cutting back and forth between all these different shots and these different ideas that, like, it creates a palpable, a visceral tension.
Yep.
Right? And, like, that's part of the power of it is that, and that was something that Eisenstein was very aware of, was that he was using it to be a political provocateur. He knew that the use of montage and these rhythms and the speed of it, the speed of the cutting creates a tension and something that you can't help but have like a palpable physiological response to, even nearly 100 years later. You mentioned the language of it and that it's so different from the stuff that we watch today, and it's a silent film. But we've watched other silence for this show. I think probably the only other silence that you've seen. And how might you compare the language of this to something like The Kid or like Buster Keaton's Sherlock Jr.?
That's an interesting question that I hadn't considered. There for sure is more, there are more words. It feels, or no. I mean, the things that they're saying are so different. And obviously the tone is different. I don't know. I don't know that I'm prepared to answer that question.
That's fair. That's fine.
I wish that I was. I mean, obviously I've liked all of those, all of these movies. I've enjoyed an awful lot. But they are, you know, for someone who has grown up in a world where, you know, color photography and sound are so integral to film, and the, like, the vocal performance of actors is so important. It can take a minute to adjust to the vocabulary that they're using.
Let's say, in comparison to The Kid, does Battleship Potemkin cut more or less often, do you think?
Battleship Potemkin cuts more.
It cuts more often. Which feels more, or does Battleship Potemkin feel more or less abstract than, or like, or on a spectrum of realistic to abstract or naturalistic to abstract, where would you place the Battleship Potemkin?
More abstract?
I would say it's more abstract.
Yeah.
Even though the world it presents is realistic, but the presentation of it borders on abstraction.
Yeah, it's talking, it's very clear that even though, as you say, it's in, like, the real world, so to speak, it's talking in ideas more than it is talking in specifics about maybe the people or the place.
Yes, Battleship Potemkin is more about ideology and less interested in individual people. But when I say abstraction, I mean in terms of the, like, the world that is presented to you on screen. In The Kid is very easy to understand world. You're given nice big wide shots, and occasionally you push in for a medium or a close-up, but you always understand the space and the reality that you're living in. Whereas Battleship Potemkin, you're constantly cutting without any effort to root you in a spatial reality. You know, you have images on, close-ups on hands or on feet or on machinery or on weapons or on shadows, and you don't know who they belong to or necessarily what they're doing or what the context is, but you get a sense of the idea that's being conveyed, or a sense of danger or a sense of a threat, but you don't necessarily understand a story that's put together until you kind of view it in a broader context of a whole sequence cut up. So this is the difference between the Western and especially the Hollywood-dominated continuity style of editing versus the Soviet. And the Soviets really pushed back, and they tried to expand their influence in a bigger way. But the Hollywood stuff was just way more palatable. And that Western style that was so rooted in theatricality and in narrative and in character, like, took off and made ass tons more money, even in the Soviet Union. Like, this movie played for its premiere right at the end of 1925 as, like, a commemorative event to celebrate the 20th anniversary. And the head of, like, Soviet propaganda and film distribution basically had to be convinced and browbeaten by other people, like, no, you need to distribute it. Like, we should show it to people. And even when they did, it didn't really make that much money. Even in the Soviet Union, like, the Western stuff and the Hollywood silence and the comedies were making way more money at the box office.
Wild.
And it's not just, like, a cultural thing. It's that the Hollywood stuff is easier. It's just easier to understand.
Also, and to relate, right? Like, there's a performer on screen, and we like people. Like, people generally respond to other people.
Right.
So a movie that relies on performance, on like that empathy, makes sense that it would be more successful. This movie, there aren't people. Like, there are, but there's no one for you to glom onto and really like imprint on.
It's funny because it feels like the montage school, to me, once I learned about montage in film school and learned about all the different ways, it felt like somebody gave me a way to articulate the types of things that I was drawn to in movies, because I have always, not always, but I have long appreciated movies that are more intellectual in their execution and in their editing. Things that, well, like cinema can do a couple of different things, but like there's the Western school, which says that movies can recreate literature and theater. And then there's this like Soviet school that says that movies can recreate poetry. It's kind of how I've always thought about it. And there is poetry in this movie. And I don't mean that to like elevate this above something else,
above Hollywood,
but it's radically different. It's poetry is about putting different ideas together in a different meter or a different rhythm or a different rhyme scheme or whatever, but it's not about narrative continuity. And like, you know, the Western school is dominant, and the Soviet era obviously no longer exists. And like, there's still people who are practitioners of this, and you see it like trickle out in broader or more available or more mainstream movies. Like, not that it was super mainstream, but something we covered on the show, She Dies Tomorrow, very much has a montage sensibility in a lot of its sequences. And a poetic sensibility where you cut away to something that has nothing to do spatially or narratively with what you're looking at, but you shove it in there and you create a new meaning. And so much of what gets produced out of the Western film canon today is just continuity and clarity. And it's become something that I just think of as television. Like, everything is just shot like television, in like wides, mediums, and close-ups, and there's no art to it, and it's just about what's the easiest way to convey the dialogue and the plot.
Here's old man Hudson, get off my lawn.
I'm just saying, Jamie, what if we did something else with the goddamn medium? What if we did something else with it? What if we didn't just make Kendall Jackson Chardonnay? There's a place for that, but we can make other things, right?
I'm 100% with you. I just wanted to antagonize you.
That's fucking fine.
Which is my thing. No, I mean, and it bears itself out. I like your comparison from like narrative to poetry. It bears itself out even in print, right? Novels make more money than poetry.
Yeah, not a lot of money to be made in writing the next great American poem.
Nope. Or even the next great American anthology of poems.
Right.
Like, the people just don't, for whatever reason, click in. And I struggle too. You know, with poetry sometimes, sitting down and reading a poem and thinking about it. And, you know, it's not always the thing that I am keen to do. But when I find one like this movie that like touches a nerve, it sticks with me for a really, really long time. Like, God, I'm forgetting the author's name, but John Donne, Death Be Not Proud. That poem has stuck with me since high school. It's like the one that still, like, I can still hear lines from every now and then when I experience a thing that evokes it. But I still don't like seek out the form, and I don't 100% know what that's about. But it's probably this like accessibility or empathy that we have to performance, to continuity, to narrative.
Well, and you know, some people just like to live in their bubbles, and they like stories, and they like characters, and if they don't get characters, they get real upset about it. And a lot of people just prefer whimsy, and if they can't get that, then they kind of dig their heels in.
Just fucking throwing stones out here.
I ain't throwing stones. This motherfucker. I don't live in no glass house.
I like whimsy.
Yeah, you like whimsy. It's your favorite.
But also, this, speaking of a poem that touches a nerve, Battleship Potemkin will live with me for quite a long time.
That is very encouraging.
Yeah. I mean, it had me locked in from the moment it started, and I was you know, I watched the narrative unfolding and kind of wondering where it was going. Because it feels like maybe the end is mutiny, right? But it's not.
Did you have any frame of reference like it?
None.
I was reading a bunch about this leading up to this recording, and like Roger Ebert in his, you know, not review, but like an essay that he wrote about the movie a few years ago, or I guess a few years before his death. He wrote something to the effect of the Battleship Potemkin is like one of those cultural artifacts, like the 23rd Psalm or like Beethoven's Fifth, that like it is so ubiquitous and so familiar that even if you're watching it, it is hard to like see it for what it truly is and not just for the like calcified cultural object that it's become and all the references that are there to it. And I identify with that. But like, does this movie mean anything? Like, did you know that this was the thing with the staircase and the baby carriage? Like,
nope.
you had no association for this.
None at all.
Right. Most people don't. Okay.
For better or worse, I went in entirely cold. Like, I knew that it was a piece of Soviet propaganda. That's what I knew.
Soviet prop.
And, you know, when you know that it's a piece of propaganda, or when I know it's a piece of propaganda, I'm like a little bit on guard. You know, like, this is a nefarious attempt by a government to change the minds of the masses or whatever, but it got me just immediately. Well, and partly because I'm predisposed to these ideas, but also partly to just the power of this film. It fucking rules.
It's very good. Yeah. It, you know, there's a reason it's still taught and still stands the test of time. Like, it's extremely well made by a goddamn 27-year-old who was just like making shit up as he went along. It's quite good. Well, if I'm glad you enjoyed this, because at some point before the end of the year, if we actually do our Sight and Sound 2022 list top 10 miniseries, we're going to have to do another iconic piece of Soviet montage, which is Ziga Vertov's The Man with the Movie Camera.
Okay.
Which is like a little bit propaganda-y, but it's also just like this crazy experimental observational documentary that does bananas things with the camera and like really pushes the idea of intellectual montage to a crazy place. So this is encouraging, because that movie could be alienating to you. But like you were saying before, with this in here, that, you know, with each wine that you drink, that it better prepares you to drink other things and have a better context for things that are maybe a little bit outside the standard deviation or whatever. Like this movie, with its compelling narrative and politics that your fucking simpering liberal sensibilities can appeal to.
Fuck you, buddy.
That might prepare you and open the door to make Man with the Movie Camera more palatable for you. Because otherwise, you might just find it weird as fuck.
I'm excited to watch it.
It's great.
And I'm definitely excited
Big
to
fan.
Watch it.
It's in the top 10. But yeah, that's all I have to say here. I'm done discussing Battleship Potemkin.
So does it pair with Domaine Ue, Demisek?
No. Probably not, right? We didn't even try. I don't know that this is worth discussing. Like,
yeah, no, it doesn't.
No,
it's nothing. It's a nothing. The wine's good. The movie's good. We have a good time.
Yeah.
There's kind of not anything here.
Yeah. I got nothing.
Though. I have absolutely nothing.
It's such a like cerebral experience watching the movie, because like for as visceral as it is, like it cuts so rapidly and is moving so quickly and does not ever hold your hand that like I would never even want to look away from the screen to like get my glass up. I would not want to be distracted from it, because it's just something that I find so rarely in a lot of like contemporary movies, that it is fully engaging, like narratively, emotionally, viscerally, and intellectually. Like, you are actively engaged in creating the movie, right? Like, that's the thing about intellectual montage, is that you are an active participant in deriving meaning from it. And if you're not looking at it and not fully engaged, then like you're missing the movie. You're missing the part where the filmmaker invites you to like be the participant and derive meaning from these different juxtaposed ideas. You were looking at Instagram the whole time, weren't you?
You were just scrolling
the feed.
Well, that I was actually going to comment on that, because a lot of times when I watch movies, you know, I will get distracted by my phone. Not necessarily Instagram, but also not necessarily not Instagram. You know, a lot of my work ends up on my phone and, you know, I'll get a Slack message or whatever, or an email or something, and have to respond really quickly. At the end of this movie, I realized that I didn't know where my phone was. Like, I had switched positions on the couch, such that I was sitting on my phone. And not until it ended did I realize that I didn't have a bead on where the damn thing was.
That's the power. It's the power of the ghost of Sergei Eisenstein, who comes to your house and hides your phone from you so you don't fucking pay attention to what's on screen. You capitalist dog.
No, man, I'm a comrade. I'm part of the revolution.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Really? Going out for your master SOM exam?
Oh, go fuck yourself.
You are your own business owner, Jamie. You're a capitalist. You're a capitalist, okay? You're a capitalist. I anticipated this very line of conversation, by the way. Like yesterday, I'm like, at some point, Jamie is going to align himself with the cause and say that he's a communist. And I will need to point out to him that he's...
you're not wrong.
Yeah.
And it's a thing that I struggle with a lot.
Hey man, you gotta
because
eat.
I gotta eat, and I like the creature comforts, and I recognize that we live in a capitalist society, and
right.
I kind of need to engage in order to live a life,
right? And otherwise, to eat all your fancy foods.
Otherwise, it becomes actual bloody revolution, which I don't know that I'm prepared for.
I don't think you would do well in bloody revolution.
I don't think you would either.
Oh, that went without saying. I would do very badly in bloody revolution.
I can imagine the two of us.
So incredibly badly. Yeah.
Oh, man. Just like hiding somewhere. This will all blow over.
You know what? This is the thing that I have come to increasingly as I have aged is that, especially like when I'm watching movies, like I have a great empathy for cowards. You know, like I no longer judge the cowards. Like, you know what? I get it. Sometimes your body is just panicked and is flooding your brain is flooding your body with like terror chemicals that tell you to run the fuck away. Yep. Like I can empathize with that. And I don't judge you quite so much, cowards of war movies.
I'm 100% with you on that one.
I would like to think I would not be a coward in such a situation, but I would also hope that people would not judge me if I was.
They would. They would, Scott.
They would definitely would. Well, I'd be dead, so I wouldn't be around to hear the judgment.
Not necessarily. You might have run away and survived.
And survived.
Because the cowards often survive.
That's true. Or they take the coward's way out. Well,
oh,
Jamie,
man.
For part three of Jamie's unimaginatively named CMS curricula, Master Som, tasting exam, blind tasting, use the correct rubric grid, goddammit, Scott, miniseries.
Well,
what are we drinking next time?
So next time we are drinking Gurgitch Hills, Napa Valley, Sauvignon Blanc.
I do love Sauvignon Blanc.
Sauvy B, which apparently the Australians call Sauvy Bobby, and I don't know why they do that. It's weird.
I think I know why they do it, and it's because it's fun to say. Like, if I put Sauvy B on a menu of options next to Sauvy Bobby, I'm taking Sauvy Bobby every time.
You're not wrong. It's Sauvy Bobby. So this is, they call it the Gurgitch Hills Fumé Blanc, which we'll talk about that nomenclature because it's relevant. This is the 2018 bottling. It's available, once again, at Crush Wine Company. That's crushwineco.com for $33.95.
A borderline reasonable price. Well, to go along with that, but not paired with that, because we ain't doing that this time. We're continuing to move forward in both time and, I guess, not space, just time. But we're leaving the Soviets and we're going back to Europe. And we are at last watching Louis Buñuel's Ancien Andalou, a classic bit of 1920s French experimental, poetic, surrealistic dream imagery, art,
you
cinema.
Eurocentric fuck.
Hey, man. The whole point here.
You imperialist, Eurocentric fuck.
Hey, Jamie, are we doing wines exclusively picked by the hoity-toity imperialist Western influence CMS?
We're doing exactly the same thing. Well chosen, Scott.
This is the same shit that I was taught in film school. Anyway, Al Shi'an Andalou, you can stream it on the YouTube. It's in the public domain.
It's 15 minutes long.
It's widely available. It's not long. It's got crazy imagery. It's a little evocative and violent at times. So, like, be forewarned. And then check back in with us next time as we watch that and drink a Sauvy Bobby.
Sauvy Bobby motherfucker.
I'm cutting that part out. That was terrible.
No, whatever. Thanks for joining us, everybody.
Thank you.
Please follow us on the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod. Email us with any questions, concerns, comments, or international reviews you'd like us to share on the air at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com. And please make sure you rate, review, and follow the show wherever you get your podcasts.
Also, we're on YubTub now.
Tim Tams.
Well, we're on the Tim Tams, but we're also on the YubTub. And so far, we have two subscribers on the YubTub, and one of them is me. So even if you don't watch the show on the YubTub, which you could if you wanted to, that would be an option for you. But at least if you have a YubTub account and go ahead. And people don't know what YubTub is unless they have children and they watch Netflix's The Mitchells versus Machines, in which the old man dad calls it YubTub. It's YouTube. I'm talking about YouTube.
They fucking got it. Context.
I don't know that they did. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, Bigger Bottle Pod, same name it always is, and then maybe more people will watch it. And I'm told that'll make the analytics go up. This episode was produced and edited by Scott Hudson. That's me. Our art is by Ross Connor. Thank you so much, Ross. And thanks to Rebecca McCracken for helping out with social media and project management.
Remember, everyone, drink more wine and watch more movies. It's good for you. We promise.
Jamie's a capitalist, everybody. Don't let him tell you otherwise.
But I want to be a communist. But no, I like creature comforts.
No, you don't. You really like creature comforts. Yeah.
I love creature comforts. I like champagne.
Fucking Instagram, Jamie. I know how much money it seems like you probably spend on meals out every night. When the revolution comes, you're not going to be first against the wall, but you're not going to be last either. Okay?
You either, buddy.
Yeah, I don't know. It'll start in the cities, though, so it'll take a while to work its way out to me. They'll catch up with me eventually.
That's fair.